prior felony offense, and that he was once given that chance in a great hope that he may make a success of himself, and he did not. He committed another felony. And in probably 50%, I'm guessing, but in a large measure, in a large share of those situations, the court's probably going to give him more than what would be the presumptive sentence, even if he was subject to presumptive, because he blew it, because he was given the chance and he didn't take it to heart. He committed another felony after the period of his SIS or the period of his probation. The court's still going to know that. So what you have in the first instance when the SIS was given was a decision by the judge that this activity does not deserve treatment as a felony on his record forever. And then later on, the judge, knowing that he gave him that chance, he still got the discretion. He still has the authority to take it into account, the fact of the previous SIS, but the legislature just hasn't said you must give him then the 2-year presumptive sentence or the 4-year presumptive sentence, whatever it is. But on a first offense, please don't lose track of the fact that on a first offense, the court has the authority to give the person anywhere up to the maximum in any case, whether he had a prior SIS in his background or whether he had a prior clean record, if the facts are extraordinary enough that the facts of the case do. There is another thing that strikes...
Excuse me. I tend to take your side of this argument, but what's the harm in it? I mean, the bill as written, I think sometimes we get crime bills that are sort of cosmetic almost. I don't think that they do much. Apparently they don't do much because crime still is a problem in our society. It seems to be permissive. It says that a conviction set aside under this section is a prior conviction and may be used as a factor in aggravation and classification in a licensing proceeding. I mean, if you look at it that way, what's if the judge knows about it anyway and the SIS may be used, what's the damage?
Are you referring specifically to the invoking the presumptive sentence or for the licensing and other alternative
applications? All of the above. Yeah.
One of the problems that I have with using a prior SIS to invoke the presumptive if there's a second felony is two or threefold. One, the court felt at the time that it wasn't deserving of the felony stigma, and that was a choice that he made, as opposed to the other situations where the court consciously decides not to give an SIS because he wants it considered for presumptive sentencing later on. And I'm a believer in the judiciary to the extent that they ought to and have proven themselves more often than not to apply their discretion very judiciously, for lack of another word. Another consideration, the concern that I have about that is one of fairness. There have been many cases over my term of years that I can speak about from experience where a person has entered a plea knowing that the state was going to non-oppose the defense attorney's argument for a suspended imposition of sentence. That unwritten and unstated understanding having been made with the prosecutor at that time, or even formalizing it, going into Rule 11 plea agreement, if you will. We're entering this plea, Your Honor, because we've been induced by the state's promise to allow my client benefit of an SIS. So now the state's gotten benefit of the plea rather than the trial, and still are sneaking around the back door and somehow taking away the benefit of that bargain after the fact, if you will. It strikes me as unfair for a person to make a conscious decision to give up his trial, knowing that the state was non-opposed to their argument for a suspended imposition sentence, which means he's going to get it in most cases, and then later on to steal from him the benefit of that bargain, if you will. That's not fair, because that's not the understanding within which the plea was entered. There will be, and please believe me, this is in no way a threat from our agency or anyone else, but as a practical consideration, there has to be some impact on the trial rate, on the expense rate, if you will, on the fact that there will be fewer pleas because it's going to put cases within the ambit of presumptive sentences that need not be there, that would not otherwise be there, that are now, when a person's subject to presumptive sentencing, he's going to go to trial more often than not. And this whole category of cases now falls within that consideration.
Excuse me, I'm not a criminal law specialist like you are, so I have... the lawyers here nod and agree with that, I can see.
Well, I don't know if you are.
But as I read this, it says it may be used as a factor in aggravation under Title 12. I thought that meant that if the case is otherwise appropriate for presumptive sentencing, that it becomes an aggravating factor, not that it puts the case into presumptive sentencing.
It does both, Senator Josephson. And House and Senate Bill 98, in subparagraph F, it indicates that a conviction set aside under E of this section is a prior conviction under 1255-145. That's the section of Title 12 that lays forth what can be considered as prior felonies for the purpose of invoking the presumptive sentencing scheme in the first place. Then it takes another bite out of it and makes it, in addition to that, an aggravating factor in other situations. And if I recall correctly, 155C8 is that subsection of the state's aggravating factors that says if prior misdemeanors and felonies indicate a continuing scheme of or assaultive behavior, I think is the one, then they can be used for purposes of aggravation later. So they get you coming and going. Didn't like that. One last thought, and I'll quit this. There is provision in that same section of the statute for people who have been unequivocally discharged from either prior parole or prior probation 10 years before. It keeps them or disallows those prior convictions for use in invoking the presumptive sentence. And it strikes me that when a court, based on the lack of seriousness of the offense or the great hope of rehabilitation, determines that a certain case is appropriate not to be considered for a felony for the term of this young person's life, that maybe they should be considered in the same basket, that maybe this should also be dealt with as one of those remote cases, remote convictions, if you will, just like the person whose conviction is over 10 years old, based on that decision. That's all I have, unless you have questions.
Madam Chair, it doesn't seem to me, though, that it's really unfair as a bargain, on the bargain aspect. I mean, first of all, if the legislature changes the law, you would advise your clients, this is the good part about SIS, this is the bad part, and you better stay out of trouble. I mean, I don't think that in any kind of sporting theory, there's nothing really unreasonable about that, as long as it's perspective and the client knows.
At the point on, if he knows, this is going to impact quite a number of past defendants. One thing that's different about SIS as compared to giving someone 4 years and suspending two and having them do two, which is a suspended sentence, but a suspended imposition of sentence, it's not getting a whole lot for nothing either. Part of the negative impact or the other side of the sword with an SIS is if you violate your conditions of the SIS, the court has the capability and the authority to sentence you to anything it could have given you the first day. If it's a maximum 5 years, you don't get just that amount that was suspended, but that entirety. So here you have a gentleman or woman, however it may be, who has run the additional risk of if they foul up, they're going to get more. They have successfully done it. The court's determined that it shouldn't be felony stigma from that point on in any case if they've met their part of the bargain and struck with the court, and then to come back and use it again after they've done their part. That makes it not so sporting, I think.
I think I'm going to have to call this discussion to a halt. I certainly appreciate that.
Thank you.
Testimony. Simply because we only have 15 minutes left in which to address the remainder of our itinerary for today. And I think what we need to do on this is look at a little further on what effects this would have as far as financial effects upon the state, even with the zero fiscal note, and to possibilities of duplication or combining of bills.
You're going to hold this?
Yes, I'm going to hold both of them to take a look at it. The next bill before us is Senate Bill Number 8, an act relating to personal safety curriculum in public schools. Joyce, I assume. Oh, somebody's here from the office. Okay. I'm not supposed to recognize them. Oh, I got it mixed up in all the rest of this town.
No, I got it.
Suzanne Lombardi from Senator Cadoule's office.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just open that door.
Yeah, I think it's quieter out there now. It's
Senators, my name is Suzanne Lombardi. For the record, I'm an aide for Senator Cotula, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify on committee substitute for Senate Bill 8 today. Essentially, what this bill is doing is it's adding information to the health curriculum on personal safety. And this is adding the information to the list of subjects that school districts are encouraged to teach students to help them to protect themselves. Specifically, is to identify and prevent child abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, and domestic violence. This bill is a strong policy statement from the legislature that this information should be taught to students. Statistics have shown that unless the cycle of abuse is broken with children, that it tends to perpetuate itself throughout the generations. Now, districts in Juneau and Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Mat-Su Valley are already working in conjunction with their local domestic violence and sexual assault programs in implementing and disseminating this crucial...
Susan, let me interrupt you right here. We're having so much business over here. I know it's bothering you. Those of you who've looked in your packet and do not see a committee substitute, the committee substitute state affairs adds the word neglect.
Thank you.
And I don't think it's in here. Well, it's take your Senate Bill 8 that's in your packet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you will chew that.
Oh, I see that.
Okay. Then that's what we're talking about on committee substitute state affairs.
So do you not have the committee substitute?
No.
Is that what,
I don't.
Okay,
that's what the problem is all over there. It adds the word neglect on line 17, page of the page. Now then, Susan, can you pick up where I am?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I was discussing is that the districts in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Mat-Su Valley have already been working in conjunction with their local sexual assault and domestic violence programs, and they've implemented some of these. For those that have not, for those districts in the state that have not implemented this, the legislature would be sending them a message. The fiscal note that's attached is from the Department of Education, and it's for $75,000. Is there one attached?
In state affairs, was there any, is anyone here to speak to this fiscal note today? Was there any question in state affairs of the size of the fiscal note, or by Senator Cattula?
Not that I know, Madam Chair. I'm not
Be prepared.
We don't have the Senate.
Go ahead.
Okay. The Department of Education will be working with the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault to develop and review this curriculum where it is necessary. The Senator realized the necessity for flexibility within each district, but this bill addresses the tremendous need for the students to be taught how to be safe from emotional and physical harm in today's society. One recommendation that the Senator has for the committee to consider is possibly adding to that same list where neglect was added to also add abduction. Because I'm sure the committee is aware that many times, as a prelude to, for instance, child sexual assault or emotional abuse, a child is abducted first.
Thank you. May I?
I was just going to give her a chance to finish, but go ahead.
Oh, I'd like to do that, too.
Okay.
Did you complete your statement, or?
Yes, okay.
I'm not clear what is meant here by the statement that the district is encouraged to initiate and conduct the program, and that the state board sets guidelines. What is the concept here insofar as local control is concerned?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, what I'm concerned about, partly as the parent of an infant daughter, is that the kind of materials which a young person is exposed to about the issues of sexual abuse, neglect, child abuse, are necessarily very sensitive and affect community values and perhaps the parent's right to bring that material of the parent's choice to the child. I realize that you want to promote a statewide alertness and sophistication and being tuned to the kind of materials that are being used in the nation, but I'm also concerned about how you're going to deal with a situation where you have a board of education and parents in the community who may not like the model, you know, proposal that the state DOE puts out. In their community, they don't want, for reasons of, you know, religious principles or ethnic principles, they don't want that kind of material. They want something else. I mean, how are you going to deal with that?
Madam Chair, may I respond? Senator Josephson, as far as I understand the bill, this bill does not mandate anything. This bill simply encourages school districts.
Yes.
So that if, in fact, a school district is not receptive or does not want this program, they don't have to accept it.
Well, I was asking about the guidelines in line 19. What by regulation guidelines? I mean, I'm wondering if you're creating local autonomy in the one hand and taking it away in the other.
I think that Senator Josephson would be more appropriate for Department of Education because that is the existing law.
Well, it's existing law as to health education, but it's not existing law as to personal safety education.
Yeah.
But they'd be working with the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Well, to be kind of graphic about it, I don't know much about this area, but conceivably, one way of instructing children to what to be alert to would be by using anatomically correct dolls in first grade. Okay. Now, it may be that in a given district, parents don't want that. I want to know whether, under the authority to, by regulation, establish guidelines, the state is going to tell that district that you must provide those dolls in first grade, or whether the local parents can say, we don't want to do that. We want to have a different kind of program. I think it's a fair question.
That's a legitimate question.
What I'll have to do, Sir and Josephson, is research and get back to you.
As I understand it now, there are a number of school districts, and I know exactly what Senator Takula, I think, is trying to do, and that is in the school districts that do not have this training, see that the Department of Education sees that there is some sort of training, whether set up on a local basis or on a statewide basis, but see that it's encouraged. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. This part, you know, we've got the same problem, I think, here that we've had in a couple of bills of who does what in what area. And if I understand the senator as much as I think I do, and working with him over a number of years, his object is to get the job done, minus a lot of particulars and minus saying you have to do it this way. Is that the intent? Is that his goal?
The goal is essentially to send a message from the legislature that this is crucial information that needs to get out to our students.
and encourage
each district to do it. Through the Department of Education and the Council on Domestic Violence would get together and set up a program, and then each district had the ability to choose whether they wanted that program or not.
There's one thing that bothers me about that, in that we have some very good materials already developed, and we have in most school districts, and I think that's the thing that bothers most of the urban area schools. We have curriculum committees within those schools who work on those type things, where they may not necessarily exist in your REAAs or your small school districts. And the goal then is to help those to have the best possible materials available for them from which to choose at their own discretion what to use. Is that, am I putting it as fairly as possible?
Yes, ma'am, sure.
Then I think that in a way this does that, but it is not clear exactly what that level of responsibility is. Is that what bothers you, Senator Joseph?
Yes, that's right. I think the term, it's not the guidelines I'm worried about. It's the phrase by regulation, which modifies now personal safety as well as health. You, Senator, have been one of the leaders concerned about regulations and how those can be, with just a touch of a dab of legislation, they can become quite extensive. And I really say this as a parent because I know like other parents, I want to be able to protect my daughter and educate her to the world, but I also want to, you know, protect a certain degree of innocence. I don't want her to be hostile and leery of everyone either. So the question is, how do I strike that balance? And I don't want to be in the situation of feeling that the material given to school is not appropriate, but not being able to do anything about it at the local level, because there are regulations of DOE which set out the guidelines, and I go down to my board of education, and they say, well, this comes out of JUNO, and maybe I may or may not comport with what other parents in my district want, and that is my concern, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Joseph. If we could, then I would like to hear from the Department of Education. Maybe that clarifies some of this, and maybe we can look at where our problems are and try to solve them.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Steve Hole from the Department of Education. The existing regulation required by the statute, I might add, and I would like to add that, you guys told us to, has been repealed. We now provide the guidelines as guidelines, not by regulation, but in the form of recommended curriculum materials that we are making available to school districts in our model curriculum.
Then you would have no objection as a department, nor would the sponsor have an objection, or would the sponsor have an objection to, while we're into this legislation, taking away that word regulation and put guideline. There's one problem.
Madam Chair, did he say it had been repealed?
That's correct. It has been repealed.
As to personal
You're talking
safety.
About the regs, though, not the statute.
I'm talking about the regs.
As to health or personal safety?
Well, now it only exists as to health. The same would be true.
Yeah, you mean you're saying that the legislature mandated you to do it, and now you're happy to report that you repealed the regulations we mandated you to do it?
That's correct. Yeah.
Well,
that's correct.
Great. Well, why
they
is
wrote
that?
The regs, so.
Yeah, but I mean, if you were mandated to write regulations, why wouldn't you be mandated to keep some regulations on the books?
We had a regulation entitled The Handbook for Health Education, Framework for Health Education.
I'm grumpier than normal because I have the flu, I must tell you.
Now feel free to take it out on me. at one time, it was very chic, for want of a better word, to put everything in regulation, even if it isn't a regulation. So we had a lot of guidelines, handbooks, all kinds of stuff required by in regulation. They really weren't regulations. This is one of them. We feel very strongly that it is the judgment of the school boards in this state that is best applied to the determination of what is appropriate to be taught in their schools. So while we require by regulation many processes, for instance, the development and evaluation of curriculum, just what goes in that, we leave to the school districts. That's what we're doing with our model curriculum, and frankly, that's what I would hope we could do with anything developed, assuming this legislation were to pass. We would convene a lot of folks who were working in the field, not only the council, the people from HNSS, people from that deal in those areas, and get their best judgments as to how to approach it, and then hold it out. If the districts want it, there it is. If they don't want it, they're free to develop their own, or they're free to not have it at all.
Which brings up my problem with the fiscal. Do you not have on staff at this time people who do that, who help and assist in the development of curriculum?
Yes, we do.
Then, by the fiscal note, it seems to me that you're requiring at least one other body to handle this one-time shot. Is that so?
That's correct.
Why?
Because it's going to take somebody full-time to do the job and do it right in one fiscal year. It's going to take somebody who
then
has nothing
else
to do.
You're going to hire one body for 1 year and 1 year only. Is that correct?
No, we're not going to hire anybody. We're going to contract, probably undoubtedly by competitive bid, with an agency to pull all this stuff together, coordinate with the council, with HNSS, with the folks out in the field that need to be involved, presumably several village health persons who deal with these people not only on a medical but a social level, and get all those folks together, collect whatever information presently exists, and begin to set out in an orderly fashion the process to get this product developed.
With all the existing good materials, not only here in Juneau, but in other areas of the country, you mean it's going to take one person full-time to do this job?
That's our best guess. there is a lot of material out there that needs to be reviewed.
I'd like to apply for the job in the month of July. And I guarantee I'll take care of it in 1 month.
Thank you. Steve, how much thought has gone into this one?
To answer your question, quite a bit, more than you might otherwise think. I looked at the fiscal note from last year. It's the same number. We've changed how we would purport to spend it. We're not going to hire somebody. We're going to contract. I have been unable to find out with any degree of satisfaction just exactly what does exist out there and the extent to which what exists can be used in Alaska school districts. But we're talking about two processes now. One is the development of curriculum materials. The other is the development of a teacher training program. And I don't know if anything exists to take into account all the areas of child abuse, sexual assault, neglect, all those things in a comprehensive teacher training package.
Well, then the teacher training package you were thinking of, is that for strictly the urban areas? Or are you thinking about the rural areas, are you thinking about the urban areas that are into the programs? You're going to go in and train them?
Well, whether it's for the rural areas or the urban areas, it's still got to be done. Because it already exists in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, really doesn't alter the fact that it's going to have to be done for the rural areas also. Uh-huh. The other thing that struck me as I was preparing the fiscal note is the extent to which some of these materials are going to have to be almost personalized based on the cultures that exist in some districts. Mm-hmm. You can't give necessarily the same information in a teacher training program in Anchorage as you have to give in, for instance, Lower Yukon, Bethel, Lower Kuskokwim. So there's going to be a high degree of crafting, if you will, according to the people that live in that particular area.
Senator Fisher,
how many people do you have on board right now that work with curriculum in the department? Do you have any idea?
I'm guessing 5-6.
5 or 6. Okay, and you feel that that combination, I guess the thing that bothers me with this thing is we're saying adequate funds to do all these things shall be provided. Now look at $75,000. And I hear you saying people are going to come in from the district's outlying area. The travel budget alone is going to be horrendous. We're talking about teacher training. I'm assuming you're not talking now any kind of a college course in teacher training. It's in-service type days.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and that's going to be a cost to the local district if they're going to give teachers time off, or the state's going to have to do something for in-service days within the district. I guess what I'm saying, to do all these things, $75,000, I wish that the Department of Corrections and those folks, when they do fiscal notes for my bills, would have your attitude, because it'd be a heck of a lot less than what we're getting. I don't think it's enough money, I guess is what I'm saying, to do those things, unless you take from existing staff, which you have the experts now. The material's already developed. They're not going to go in from ground one and start over developing. They're going to be calling from various books. This is typically what teachers do. We steal from others to come up with what we think is best for us. And in that sense, then I don't think we need a person either. I mean, that's just my reaction. I look at declining revenues, and I know $75,000 doesn't seem like much. But to do all these things, you can't do it if you're going to go out and get excess. You're going to hire a specialist and go this way. But you can do it, I'm saying, within staff. It won't cost near that if you do that. I think we farm it out is when we're getting into trouble. And I hate to see a ghetto consultant from Chicago come here and design a curriculum for our people.
I doubt very much if that's what they have in mind. But
may I respond to that, Mr. Chairman? The $75,000 fiscal note is predicated upon being able to use existing staff to the extent we can. What I would assume will happen, and keep in mind this is an assumption or a series of assumptions, what I assume will happen, if the bill were to pass, the council, HNSS, the executive branch, would get together those folks who deal with this issue, or the most knowledgeable, and that would include some of our staff people, the council staff people, and others, and come to some agreement as to the best way to proceed. And whoever got the contract, if that is indeed the best way to go, would have to work with these folks on a daily, weekly, monthly basis for submission of materials. Everybody get together and say, yeah, is this the way we want to go or no? But it would be using existing staff, but it would not be assigning existing staff full-time to do this, because they all have other things to do, too.
Excuse me, I'd like to interrupt here for a moment. I think we have one other to testify, at least. So I'd like to ask the committee. We're running into a very, and I hate to cut your testimony short, we're not through with you by any means. Well, today we may be. We are running into a very serious situation as far as time for reviewing legislation within our committee. I had questioned before, and we are working very, very hard now on the foundation program, and we have a suggested grouping for the child protection, child family protection legislation. But we're going to have a time, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, that we can devote to both write-up and to hearing some of this legislation. Now, my main job that I want to get done today is finding out when members of this committee are available. For instance, how many of you have, say, a 9 to 9:30 on Monday, Wednesday, Friday free? Or what is the most convenient time for members of this committee to devote to both hearing legislation and markup periods other than Tuesday, Thursday, 1:30 to 3:30, which always extends beyond and never gets through?
Madam Chair, that's just like resources does.
Yeah.
One time that's always generally free is 5 p.m. on, you know, on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, whether we could bear to come back. You could cut into the morning. That makes it, you know, hard a little bit on me personally because of that's the day that we also have to get ready, or I have to get ready for a resources thing. But I could take mornings, I suppose, on those.
Well, that's what I'm after. What is your...
I can't take any morning because the finance meets from 8:30 sometime to session.
Mm-hmm.
So that would eliminate 5 o'clock in the evening, Saturdays, and
you're available then at 5?
Oh, sure.
You're available at 5?
Yeah.
You're available at 5?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Edna has...
Well, CRA sometimes runs over.
They go 3:30 normally to 5. Right?
You could do it 5 o'clock on Wednesdays.
One day's not enough. About 5 on Monday and Wednesday is a trial period.
Not more than an hour?
An hour to an hour and a half. Not over an hour. We could plan on an hour and just shut it off in an hour if that's your desire. Yeah. Well, would you then mark your schedules for 5? And is there anyone here to testify on this legislation that is from out of town? From out of town. Then is there anyone who could not possibly be here?
The 20th?
Schedules real fast. What's the day today?
Today's the 19th.
On tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock? Very well. We will continue then, we'll do a little work between here and then and continue these deliberations at 5 tomorrow. Would you please notify the committee?
For, well, you'll get the ones you're going to bring back.
Yeah. And I apologize to those who did not have a chance to be heard. We're already into moving our committee into other committee meetings. Joyce? What's her
name? Yeah.